This podcast is brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is Phil Connell from Def Leppard, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
Get set for the 40th anniversary Shout at the Devil Tour. Coming to Brisbane, Suncorp Stadium, Wednesday, November 8th, Sydney Giants Stadium, Saturday, November 11th, and Melbourne, Marvel Stadium, Tuesday, November 14th, as part of their world tour. Def Leppard and Motley Crue together. My podcast guest from Def Leppard, guitarist Phil Collin. Hi, Phil.
Hey there, Gavin. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Look at you. I'm just so glad to be talking to you on the podcast today. What a career you've had individually, you know, from Hackney to the stages of the world. You've done well, my friend.
Thank you. The original Hackney Diamond. That's me.
Yes. Then you're with Diamond Albums, which sell, you know, over 10 million copies.
Yeah.
It's just brilliant. It's a great journey, isn't it?
It's a wonderful journey, and we're really appreciative of the whole thing, you know, and we never kind of take anything for granted, so which is why we're still here, I think. Yeah. You know,
so tell me about the early years. How were you introduced to music? How old were you and what happened?
One from London. So I was actually born in Hackney in East London, and I you know, just being in that environment, there was so much going on. You know, it was the center of everything musical. You know, there was just every band, or you know, the Beatles, the Stones, the Who. Yeah, then later on Led Zeppelin, Motown, reggae, you know, R&B. I mean, everything, just a mixture of punk rock. So it was kind of all around me all the time. So and obviously a huge fan of American music, and that kind of, you know, topped it off and got it all going. So yeah, I'd just been surrounded by it. And my first concert was Deep Purple. My cousin, who was 2 years older than me, got me into, you know, Hendrix and Zeppelin and Purple and Pink Floyd and that. And I went to see Deep Purple when I was 14. And after that, it was like, I need to play guitar, because I saw Richie Blackmore smashing this Strat up. And that done the trick, you know. And then from that point on, it was just immersed in it even more so, from a playing point of view as well.
So you had a pretty good idea of guitars. You did get a Gibson SG as your first guitar. That's pretty impressive.
It is, but you know, I pestered my poor mum and dad for like 2 years, and they were, you know, not well off by a long shot. You know, my dad was a lorry driver, and my mum was, you know, looked after the house at home. So yeah, they went in debt. They done all this stuff. So I kind of felt I couldn't disappoint them. So I played this thing every single day. I got it out the other day. I've got it here with me in California.
Oh, I was going to ask you whether you still had it.
Yeah, no, it sounds great as well. I plugged it in. It's like, yeah, it's all there.
Fantastic. Yeah, I had a Gibson EB3. The Rosewood one, you know, a bass guitar, and way back then, and it didn't click in. I became a lead singer instead. But boy, these days I still wish I had that guitar.
So I got an Epiphone, one of them, during COVID, and I actually learned to play, you know, fingerstyle shred bass, if you like. My friend Craig Martini, who used to play with Paul Gilbert and plays with Delta Deep sometimes, he showed me this technique, and that's what I did during COVID, and actually learned on my EB3 Epiphone. So yeah, I love it. Yeah. It was really cool.
Yeah. Now tell me, your first big band was Girl. How did all that come about?
It was post-punk with rock band, and it was a kind of a hybrid of all of that. It was like a glam rock band. It had kind of hard rock, heavy metal kind of leanings, and also just very glam rock and a little bit punk. And so, you know, it didn't really succeed. I mean, we played Europe, England, Japan and stuff, but it never really took off. But it was around the same time as Def Leppard were starting off, actually. And so, you know, I bumped into them, and I knew all the guys, you know, way before I joined. I mean, that was the thing. So we both come out of the British new wave of heavy metal, if you want to call it that. And we both felt that we weren't part of that setup, really. It was very different to what the other stuff that was going on. But it's time and a place, really. So, and that's really what happened there.
You had two great albums, though, Wasted Youth and She Agreed.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, no, we loved it. And just, like I said, it was a hybrid, and we were trying to create something based on, you know, everything. You know, there's this band called Japan that we really liked. We liked Aerosmith, the New York Dolls, and we tried to make a kind of a collection of all of that. So it's, Yeah, a tough sell, especially at that time, coming in England as well.
So tell me about the Terror Twins and Steve Clark. How did that all kind of germinate within that group of people?
When I joined Def Leppard, actually even before I was in Def Leppard, you know, I met Steve and we jammed a few times and we'd play, you know, with Joe as well. And, you know, when Joe and Steve would come down to London, they would stay at my mum's place, you know, in Walthamstow in East London. They'd sleep on the couch and stuff like that and just hang out in London. And so that's how that started, really. So we became friends. And when we, was in the same band, then it just, we're drinking buddies and and it just got kind of crazy. So someone called us the Terror Twins.
The first time I came across Def Leppard was when you had the plane with Def Leppard written on the side. Now, is there a pilot in the group?
There isn't. Oh, God, no. No, and I don't think anyone would allow a band member to fly a plane. I know I... yeah, I don't know if we'd be comfortable with that, knowing what, you know, get up to, yeah. It's like...
Yeah, because that was very impressive, and I thought, this band's got to be good. I've got to listen to this music, and, man, you blew me away.
Good to hear.
Now, you kind of joined the band, what, around 82 during the recording of Pyromania, produced by Mutt Lange?
Yeah.
And you replaced Pete Willis. I mean, that's one of the diamond albums, isn't it, Pyromania? That's sold over 10 million copies and still sells today. You know, it still could be on the charts.
Absolutely, and it's 40th year anniversary as well this year, so... That's bonkers as well, just to think, because it seemed like yesterday. I remember just, you know, playing in the studio and everything, and it just seemed not long ago. But, yeah, 4 years, just like that.
So you had a huge tour at the Marquee Club in London, kicking off in February 83, and then it ended up in San Diego, September 83. That's a long tour.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were struggling. We was opening act at first. We was playing at the Marquee as a club, you know, it's a 400-seat club. And then... you know, we were opening up for Billy Squire, playing half-empty theatres in Europe, and then all of a sudden it exploded in the States while we were out there. So that's what happened there, and that was the pinch me moment. That was the moment you couldn't believe. Probably the most exciting moment of our career when you went from opening act to headliner, you know, in sold-out arenas. So yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah, to finish at the big stadium in San Diego, that must have been a blast for you.
It was, and you know, it was almost like, you know, a boy band type of thing, you know, because we were very young, and it was still more Duran Duran than it was, say, Iron Maiden. It was still kind of right in the middle there. So you had this kind of pop following, and MTV had just started, so it was a brand new, a visual thing. So it had a lot of pluses and stuff going for it, and the music wasn't particularly heavy metal. It was like somewhere in between. It was like a rock band that you could actually sing along to. So, yeah, it was a very interesting time period for sure.
Tobin Brothers believe every life is unique. Every funeral should be too. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Phil Collin from Def Leppard, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
I'm speaking with Phil Collin, the guitarist with Def Leppard, and it's such a pleasure to have him on the podcast. Now, in 84, disaster struck, Phil, with Rick Allen in the car accident, losing his left arm. That must have been after all that success in the big tour, all of a sudden, you know, the highs and the lows of rock and roll.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, any family that I've known, my family, everyone has terrible things happen in them. You know, we have births, deaths, marriages, divorces. You have all of these things happen. And being in a band is no different. The fact that we've been together for 40 odd years, you're going to have more things happening. But that was really a weird one, because when I got the phone call, you know, they said, Rick Allen's had his arm severed. And I'm like, well, what does that mean exactly? And they said, well, he's lost his arm. They tried to reconnect it. That it didn't take. And then he, you know, had to learn how to be a human being again, you know, because he just felt he was in bed and everything at first, and be a drummer as well. So it was the normal thing that we take granted, like standing up or, you know, cutting a loaf of bread or things like that, tying your shoelaces. He couldn't do all of that. So just to be what we would consider normal, he had to really work at that. And then on top of that, to play drums. But he was just wonderful with it. Mutt Lange, you know, gave him some inspiration earlier on. He went to see him in a hospital and said, look, you can still do this drumming thing. It's like you just got to get all the normal stuff together first and you know, reconnect and all of that. And it worked, and it worked a treat for him. You know, he really worked hard.
Now, There was a time when you considered leaving the band. Was that around that time, or was before or after that time?
When Steve died, that was the thing. And there was something a little bit later where I felt that all the hard work we'd put in there, we should have been in a different position. So we kind of rectified that, and we made sure we were in a different position. We changed management and just worked a lot harder, and then it all started kind of happening for us again. So, yeah.
So glad you worked through it. Mate, the Hysteria album, on the charts for 3 years.
Yeah.
That's incredible in itself. Over 25 million copies sold. 7 singles from that album. There's not so many albums that can boast 7 big hit singles.
No, I think when we started recording it, Mutt Lange, our producer, said, let's not do Pyromania Part 2. Let's do a rock version of Thriller, and Thriller by Michael Jackson had 7 singles off it. So that was the goal. And yeah, for sure. But when Hysteria came out, it first off, it kind of tanked, and we were still in massive debt because it cost so much to make. But we just kept touring it, keep trying, and you know, the team, our management and the crew and the band and everything really worked so hard at it, and the label, everyone just really pushed. In fact, you know, when we'd finished the really successful US tour, Peter Mench, our manager, said, look, can someone go to Australia and do some promo? It's done great in the States and in England. That. So me and Steve Clark and my mum came over to Australia and done some promo for a while. And then it kicked it off. I think the album went to number one and off we went. So it was, that worked as well.
So did mum enjoy being on the road?
Oh, loved it. Yeah, she loved it. My cousin lived in Australia. He passed away now, but she got to come out and see him, and yeah, it was wonderful. Yeah,
fantastic. Now you're also in the Guinness Book of World Records. 3 concerts on 3 continents in 1 day. That's a feat in itself. I bet you didn't take your gear with you.
It felt like a week, but it was, you know, all pressed into 1 day. So it was great. You had to play an hour to get in the book. We played in a cave in Morocco. We played the Shepherd's Bush Empire in London. And then we played the, I forget the name of this place. It was in Vancouver, Canada. I forget what it was called. But yeah, it was amazing. It was really, really a lot of fun.
Now, if I can just go off a little bit to the side, tell me about playing lead guitar for Donny Osmond.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so I actually... And this is a great story because I done some backing vocals with him as well on one of his solo albums. And he said, this is great, great. This is really cool. Is there anything I can do for you? And I just moved to this house, actually, in California. And he was a neighbor. He actually lived in Irvine, which is like just down the road. And he had a big truck. And I said, there is one thing you could do for me if you want. My son, we ordered a crib and I haven't got a truck yet. I've got a little car. Do you think you could pick this crib up? And he said, yeah, no problem. So I told them and I said, someone's going to pick the crib up. And they said, well, who is it? And I said, Donny Osmond. And they're like, oh, yeah, right. But he did. He went, got my son's crib and brought it over, which was ultra cool of him and just freaked them out, obviously. But no, he's lovely. And I'm a day older than him. We're both Sagittarians, both born 1957, December 8th and 9th. So, yeah, they're really cool.
Oh, that's great. Now, also, there was an Australian connection when you played and produced 1991 album On the Edge for Australian band B.B. Steel. How did that come about?
Yeah, when I was over there with Steve Clark and my mum, someone introduced me to Craig, who was the singer in B.B. Steel, and we got talking and we just done a single. And then after that, I was like, well, do you want to do the album? So... yeah, we actually went to Canada. We actually recorded. It was cheaper to go to Canada and record this album than it would have been to stay in Oz. So we went out there and it was great and loved how it turned out. It was really super cool. And yeah, and hopefully I'll see Craig when I'm over there in a couple of weeks.
He's in Adelaide, right?
Absolutely. I've been to his house.
I showed him around LA when he came over.
Really?
I lived in West Hollywood for 12 years and Craig came over with his wife and I took them around and showed them all around. So it's a small world, isn't it?
Whereabouts in West Hollywood were you?
Just opposite Barney's Beanery over Santa Monica Boulevard and in Alfred Street, one street south of La Cienega.
Well, that's where I used to live, King's Road.
Really? Around the corner. It's a small world, Phil. Now, you've lived in Orange County for over 25 years. vegetarian and colorblind. Does that affect you in any way?
No, only when someone says, you see that green thing over there? And I'm going to go, no, I can't see. Or, you know, traffic lights or, you know, those colorblind tests and all that stuff. So you have to do lights by sequence. So I have to pay more attention because either they look either orange or white. So, yeah. But a lot of people have, until it's pointed out, they wouldn't know. And I do have a pair of glasses. My son bought me some of those amazing glasses, sunglasses that you corrects everything. It just makes it more vivid, you know?
Yeah. Now, you're a vegetarian. You gave up the booze and the drugs. What was your aha moment when that happened?
Well, it's been 37 years, I think, since I've had a drink. So... or done anything, drug-wise. And I think it was coming, and I think me and Steve getting kind of really messed up, me blacking out, driving while I was drunk and all that stuff. I was like, yeah, I really can't do this anymore. So I actually stopped cold turkey. I had a few attempts earlier on, and that didn't really work out. Tried to do the social drinking, have a glass of wine and all that, and that didn't really work. So when I actually completely stopped, it worked a treat. And then I would get like 2 hours extra in a day where I wasn't recovering. So that was an amazing bonus. That's like, you know, extra life, if you like, you know.
Any song can be played at a funeral. What would you like? Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Phil Collins from Def Leppard, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
You're touring all around the world, basically with your mates now. Cheap Trick, Journey, Poison, Joan Jett, Motley Crue with this big tour. Brisbane, Suncorp Stadium, Wednesday, November 8. Sydney, Giants Stadium, Saturday, November 11. And Melbourne, Marvel Stadium, Tuesday, November 14. It must be a blast now that, you know, that you're fit and happy and there's no drugs and no booze and no girls. You can just get on and have a good time and play well.
Well, absolutely. I think that's why we're still here. You know, you can really run off track if you're doing all this other stuff. And we still make great music. You know, we just had two number one albums. Our last album, Drastic Symphonies, was number one in the classical charts for 11 weeks because we had the London, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra on that as well. And the album before that, Diamond Star Halos, which is still promoting, top 10. You know, all around the world. So, yeah, I think it makes a huge difference when that's your priority. You know, we're still very much into the artistic side of making great music that we all love and being fans of stuff and actually still putting it out there and the show and everything. And, you know, you've got to be healthy to put one of these shows on. Yeah. Plus, us and Motley Crue have been, you know, we just done South America. We done America last year, obviously. We've done South America, Europe, England, some more in the States, and obviously we'll be coming over with them when we do Oz, so that's going to be great. We get on so well with them as well.
So how's Joe Elliott's voice? He lost his voice a long time ago. Did he get the right doctors onto it and fix it up?
He did, but he actually, more than doctors, he used Roger Love, who's a vocal coach, and he got him... Actually, he sings better now than when he did when he was a teenager. So it's warming up. It's doing the right things and not abusing your voice. And you know, when you see Broadway singers or opera singers, they can still do this stuff into their 70s or 80s. And it's just looking after it. And I think what happens with a lot of pop people or rock people is they give up and they just expect it to happen for them. It's like being an athlete. You have to keep working at your body because otherwise it will stop working. And that's it in a nutshell, really. And he does. I mean, you know, one of the dates we did before, we rarely do two shows in a row, but we done LA and San Diego back to back last year. And Joe was warming up for 8 hours in, but you know, the next day before the show, and his voice sounded amazing. So it's that, you know, and people don't tend to put that much energy or effort into it. And he does. And that's the big difference.
Yeah. Now, Rick Savage and Rick Allen and also Vivian Campbell all touring with the band.
For the last 30-odd years, yeah.
That's one powerhouse band, man.
Yeah, thank you.
And tell me, the shirt-off thing, is it because I'm hot or is it because I've got a hot bod and I'm going to show you and I'm proud?
All the above, I'd say, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, mate, I'm so pleased to be talking with you. Good luck with the tour. You won't need it. You'll be sold out, you know, with the three shows. You should be doing lots more.
We will, and we're going to keep going. So we're loving it. Actually, we're having an Indian summer in our career. You know, it's kind of yeah, it's just amazing at the moment. We're just loving life. So, yeah, excellent.
That heritage rock is huge, isn't it? It's like your superannuation.
It is, but I think, you know, we see a lot of bands giving up as well, and we that's not what we do. We want to keep raising the bar. So, you know, that means even like later on today, I'll be practicing all my vocals and playing guitar, and that's you just do it every day. You know, it's again like the athlete, like a elite athlete. And it works for us, you know.
Now, Phil, a couple of questions without notice.
Yeah.
This gives us a good sense of what kind of entertaining guy you are. Name three dinner guests, dead or alive.
Oh, it would have to be Jimi Hendrix, right? You'd have to have Jimi Hendrix. Oh, Martin Luther King would be amazing, obviously. Who else we got? Go back in history, you know, you'd go back to, like, I don't know, Shakespeare or something like that. Yeah, that would be amazing.
All right. Now, what's the best show that Def Leppard has ever done? The best show.
Last year, we played the SoFi Stadium in LA, and it was one of the best shows we've ever done. Everyone's, the voices were amazing. It just clicked. The audience was incredible, and the playing was, everyone was on fire. It just all happened. Most of the time, we say we're the 90 or the 95%. So if someone has a crap gig, usually someone else is having a great one. So we always kind of get around there, but sometimes it's, you know, like that one. That was like 100%. Munich last in Europe, and also Wembley Stadium that we did, were Mexico City. I mean, these are all just amazing shows, and they've all been in the last year. So that's pretty amazing. Yeah. So we're definitely better than we ever were before.
What's your favorite song to perform?
All of them, really. You know, you can't really. I do like. We all like playing Hysteria because it's a. It kind of gets into this groove, and everyone kind of likes that song. So that kind of always seems to work as well.
Perfect. Mate, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. You are a champion, my friend. I look forward to catching up with you when you're down here.
Absolutely. Cheers. We'll see you soon.
Cheers, mate. All the best.
This podcast brought to you thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives every day of the year.